from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 4 years after General Pervez Musharraf came to power in Pakistan in a bloodless coup, militant Islamists want to see him dethroned, and they don't mind killing him to make it happen. Pakistan's president narrowly escaped two assassination attempts last month. The second came just a day after he agreed to step down as head of Pakistan's military at the end of 2004. Since 9/11, Pervez Musharraf has negotiated a precarious political balance, fighting terrorism and appeasing mullahs. Now his life is clearly on the line. If he goes, the darkest fear is nuclear-armed chaos and a big victory for al-Qaeda. Tonight on Point, Pakistan's Pervez Musharraf in the bullseye. We begin in Pakistan, where General Musharraf met today with India's Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee for talks after a long, cold spell between the nuclear-armed neighbors. Ahmed Rashid is a journalist and author of Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. I asked him to give us the highlights of the day's talks.
This is the first time that the two leaders have met, the Pakistani president and the Indian Prime Minister, in the last 2 years, and both sides are being very tight-lipped about what was discussed, but there is a lot of speculation that there, in fact, will be another meeting tomorrow between the two of them. Now, if this is the case, that could mean that maybe both sides will issue a joint statement and possibly announce a date for real talks on the disputed territory of Kashmir.
These talks come within weeks of two concerted assassination attempts on the life of Pakistan's President General Musharraf. How do these things intersect, Ahmed Rashid? Does success in these talks with India have anything to do with his success in staying alive in Pakistan?
Well, I think this particular initiative has been in the works for the last 3 or 4 months. We've seen moves made by Prime Minister Vajpayee back in August, September, and then a ceasefire declared by Pakistan in November along their common border. But certainly I think what the assassination attempts did prove was that the very militant groups that the Pakistani military has been backing in Kashmir are the very people who've turned around now and are shooting at their original sponsor, in other words, the president, who is also the army chief. And I think this has been a huge wake-up call that these same militant groups can turn around and try and eliminate the president.
So could this be, on Musharraf's part, spade work? Is he laying the groundwork here to do what Washington has wanted him to do, which is to go after these militant groups much more vigorously and try and shut them down?
Clearly, at the summit, I think the main Indian demand, what officials told me, was that Pakistan has to now go one step forward, and that is it has to actually dismantle these militant camps and also arrest or rein in some of the militant leaders themselves. Now, the Pakistanis are saying, we're not doing anything until the Indians give us a date for talks, until substantial talks start, and until it does more in Indian Kashmir towards addressing the misery of the Kashmiri people. So let's see if this deadlock is going to be broken in the next 24 hours.
And what about General Musharraf? Does he need to go after these groups in order to assure his own survival in office, his own survival period?
All of these groups have been sponsored by the military intelligence at one point in time or the other. They've either received help or support or money. There is nothing that the military does not know about these groups. If they were to go after these groups, I'm sure they could do a very, very effective job. The whole problem has been since September the 11th is that there has been a dual policy in Pakistan being pursued by the military. That is a policy on the one hand of going after al-Qaeda and selectively going after certain groups, but allowing other groups to continue.
So at this point, can they maintain that dual policy?
Well, the chickens are coming home at the moment. There's an enormous amount of pressure, especially from the Americans, on Pakistan. Not only is there pressure on trying to resolve the Kashmir issue, there is a lot of American pressure on Pakistan for allegedly supporting the Taliban, this Taliban resurgence that is taking place in Afghanistan. As you may have read in the press in the last two or three days, enormous accusations now circulating that Pakistan has proliferated nuclear technology to Iran, Libya, North Korea. The list is getting longer and longer. Now, under these kinds of conditions, I think, you know, there's a limit to how long President Musharraf can continue such dual policies.
In the meantime, you write that the president's security is in shambles. You quote a retired general saying there's a determined group with highly critical inside information that is determined to kill him.
I think certainly the feeling here is very strong, especially amongst his supporters in the military, that there is a very serious breach of security. There are a group of very extreme officers, fundamentalists, who are linked to some of these militant groups outside, who are linked to other people, technical scientists, other kinds of people, and they are trying to eliminate Musharraf because they feel that he may now decide to do a permanent crackdown on some of these groups.
If they were to succeed in assassinating President Musharraf, what would the likely follow-on be? Is there a mechanism for an orderly succession? What would that be? Or are these assassination attempts, in effect, coup attempts?
Certainly you could define them as such, because what is very uncertain is what would be the line of succession. Given that we have a quasi-military, quasi-democratic setup, the feeling is that the vice chief of the army would take over the country. He could well disband parliament, get rid of the whole democratic process that has just been set up over the last 1 year. On the other hand, he could take the decision to empower the civilians. What is certain is that there's going to be an enormous amount of wrangling and possible chaos in the hours or days immediately after, God forbid, such an assassination was successful.
And what would the Islamists hope to gain from that chaos and uncertainty?
I think the first thing that they would try and gain clearly would be they could create dissent in the army, which of course would be a very, very dangerous situation for Pakistan. They could also demand that certain officers get key jobs in the army, in other words, their supporters within the military. It's very uncertain exactly as to what would happen.
Washington has expressed confidence off the record that even if Musharraf goes, the Pakistani army is likely to maintain control and to bring on a successor who would be inclined to continue Musharraf's warm policy toward the United States. Is that confidence justified?
I think Washington has been going out of its way to try and put the political situation in a very rosy picture. I think Pakistanis here are very, very deep, much more deeply concerned than perhaps Washington is at the moment as to what would happen. Would there be a tussle in the corps commanders amongst the top generals for control of the army? All this is very unpredictable. I mean, this has been a very disciplined army. This is a British-trained and then an American-trained army. It's a top-down army. Orders are obeyed. But never before have you had this kind of attempt to eliminate the army chief in such a fashion. And I think there is still a lot of speculation as to what would happen.
Ahmed Rashid, just a day before the last assassination attempt, General Musharraf met with leaders in Pakistan and agreed to step down as army chief in 1 year, not from his presidency, but from his dual post as army chief, as a kind of concession. Does that really win him anything?
Not really. I mean, it wins him the support of an alliance of Islamic parties in parliament. Now, they're no friends of Musharraf. Their deal with Musharraf is a working arrangement. They don't agree with his foreign policy. They don't want a rapprochement with India. They support Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. They're opposed to President Hamid Karzai's government in Kabul. And they don't share his drive against counterterrorism, against terrorist groups in Pakistan. Now, many people are very doubtful that this alliance will last very long.
In sum, then, good news from Musharraf today with India, but at home, how fragile is this? Might we see another assassination attempt tomorrow?
Everybody's absolutely certain that whoever this group is, they're going to try again. There is open war between this group and the president. It's a question of whether the authorities are going to be able to arrest or capture this group, which is suspected of being quite large and broken up into several cells. Some people are saying that this group is actually drawn from many fundamentalist groups. They are all people willing to commit suicide in trying to kill the president. There's no shortage of manpower here in people who would be willing to try and launch themselves in a bid to kill the president. So I think we will see more attacks.
Ahmed Rashid, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Ahmed Rashid writes for The Wall Street Journal, London's Daily Telegraph, and the Far Eastern Economic Review. He spoke with us from Lahore, Pakistan. We are talking tonight about the precarious presidency of Pakistan's General Pervez Musharraf. He narrowly survived two assassination attempts last month. If militant Islamist groups have Musharraf in their crosshairs, how much can and should the United States do to protect him? Who wants to kill the president of Pakistan? And what will it mean for Pakistan and the world if they succeed? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Karachi, Pakistan, is Samina Ahmed, Project Director for Pakistan and Afghanistan at the International Crisis Group, a Brussels-based organization that monitors global hotspots. Good evening, good morning there, and welcome, Samina Ahmed.
Hi, thanks.
It's great to have you with us again. It's been a long time. Also with us tonight from Washington is Stephen Cohen, Senior Fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Cohen.
Good evening to you. Good morning to Samina.
Yes, there in Karachi. Samina Ahmed, to you first. Let me just put the simple question to you. You must have seen and heard a lot about these assassination attempts in the last couple, three, 4 weeks. Oh, you've got a very close view of it there. Who is behind these attacks, and what are the stakes if Musharraf's life is so acutely on the line?
First, who is behind the attacks? I mean, every second day there's another statement from government investigators, but there is as yet no conclusive evidence of the actual perpetrators who are responsible. There have been some indications that these might be groups that are linked to Islamic extremist organizations, but we still have to wait and see what the outcome of those investigations is. Second, what would be the impact of any such assassination attempt being successful? Mm. Well, I would tend to disagree with Ahmad Rashid's analysis. I think if this or any other attempt had been successful, or for that matter, Pervez Musharraf decided that he'd had enough of his military presidency and opted out, it isn't very likely that they would be absolute chaos and mayhem and, based Pakistan on the verge of collapse. This happened sometime back, 1988. General Ziaul-Haq was killed in some unfortunate accident. Still don't know if it was an assassination. Mm-hmm. Well, nothing really happened, did it?
I wonder then, let me turn to Stephen Cohen for a moment. We've just got a minute before the break here. But Stephen Cohen, there's talk, no one is hoping for, well, clearly some are, but we in this forum are not hoping for Musharraf's demise. But with these persistent attacks, we have to think about it. There's talk that his successor might very well be, if it came to that, the Army Vice Chief of Staff, General Mohammad Yusuf Khan. He is thought to be relatively pro-American, likely to continue Musharraf's prosecution of al-Qaeda. If Samina Ahmed is correct, and there wouldn't be chaos, and you'd have a successor who was more or less in line with Musharraf, then why is anybody going after General Pervez Musharraf?
Well, I think it's a personal grudge in the sense they see him as symbolizing the American tie. And I wouldn't characterize any Pakistani general as pro-American. Some are less hostile to us than others. But I agree with you, and I agree with Samina Ahmed, that if there is an assassination, it's likely that the vice chief would take over. But also you have to look on the civilian side. There's a member of the Pakistani establishment, Mohammad Mian Somru, who's the president of the Pakistan Senate. And he legally would take over as president of Pakistan, and which is what happened when President Zia died in 1988, I guess it was. So I think that I agree with Samina. I think that there would be some degree of continuity, but clearly this would be a threat to those powers in Pakistan, and the forces that would have assassinated Musharraf would certainly continue this and attempt to put pressure on the military and political establishment that dominates the country.
There is a lot we've got to dig into here, and we're delighted to have both of you to help us do it. Samina Ahmed in Karachi, please stand by, and Stephen Cohen in Washington. We are talking tonight about the precarious presidency of Pakistan's General Pervez Musharraf and all that hangs in the balance with South Asia's number one assassination target. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Can you imagine making your daily rounds these days in General Musharraf's shoes? Who is trying to kill the president of Pakistan and why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the precarious presidency of Pakistan's General Pervez Musharraf. We're joined from Karachi, Pakistan, by Samina Ahmed, Project Director for Pakistan and Afghanistan at the International Crisis Group, and from Washington by Stephen Cohen, Senior Fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. He's author of an article recently published in the Washington Quarterly, The Jihadist Threat to Pakistan. You can join this conversation as well with a bridge blowing up right behind him and suicide bombers destroying his convoy. How long can this Pakistani general and president survive? Is Pakistan's central authority being torn apart by the opposing demands of Islamists and Washington? And should the United States do more to protect Pervez Musharraf? Like what? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Samina Ahmed, I wish you'd lay out a few of the pieces in tension here. There appear to be so many lines of tension in Pakistan, it's hard to follow where the balance is. But there's the military, there's the mullahs and the moderate Islamic population. There's the Islamist, even terrorist population, whatever its size. There's the military impulse and the democratic impulse. What are the major tensions at play beneath Musharraf here?
The major tensions at play beneath Musharraf, let's be very clear about this, is that this is a military government and he's a military ruler. He came into power through a military coup. So the first and the most important divide is the divide between the civil and the military,
mm-hmm.
and then the other divide. As a result of the military's policies, as Ahmed Rashid said, there is now an Islamic threat, a threat from Islamic extremist groups linked to the military.
You're saying because a civilian or democratic impulse has been thwarted, this Islamic threat has risen?
Well, absolutely, absolutely. In the elections, national elections that were held in 2002, the liberal, democratic, secular parties were kept out of the fray,
mm-hmm.
of the electoral fray, and the religious parties were favored by the military. And because there has still been concerted action against the relatively moderate secular parties, the religious parties have benefited.
What does this say then about Washington's position vis-a-vis Musharraf and Pakistan? Is Washington reaping its own, planting here?
Well, here's the problem. I think Washington decided that it would take a shortcut in Pakistan and support a military government because the military government would deliver the al-Qaeda goods. Well, yes, it did, but any other democratic civilian government would have delivered the goods as well. So the shortcut hasn't quite paid off.
So there we are. Stephen Cohen, do you agree with this analysis of what's going on, that it's first of all the tension between military government and something more democratic, and that Washington tried a shortcut and is now perhaps paying the price?
I would agree perhaps slightly with the wording that Dr. Ahmed has given you. I think that Pakistan has been governed for many, many years, since the 50s, by essentially an autocracy, and it's a combined civil-military alliance. And many of the civilians who were involved in this were eager supporters of the Islamists themselves. And they did this cynically, not because they were Islamic extremists themselves, but because they saw the Islamists, or the radical Islamists, as instruments in foreign and domestic politics. And the military, of course, were the point persons on this. They're the ones who provided the intelligence muscle. But I think that the phrase that Ahmed Rashid used, chickens have come home to roost, is clearly the case, and I think the Pakistani elite, the establishment, is frightened. They're very worried themselves that, in fact, this monster that they fostered may turn against them and could plunge Pakistan into chaos. But Dr. Ahmed is absolutely correct that in the last election, the mainstream parties, more or less secular parties, were crippled. They were handicapped. It's as if you had an election in America and cut the votes of the Democrats and Republicans by 30%, which would allow other parties to intervene. And that's exactly what happened in Pakistan.
And this monster you're talking about having been created is presumably the sort of Islamist movement. How serious, how threatening, to whom is this movement?
Well, its threat is one of disturbance and disruption and assassination and violence. In terms of the ballot box, it's no threat at all. And if Pakistanis were allowed to vote freely, that group wouldn't have gotten more than 5 or 10% of the vote in any election.
Even in these border provinces along Afghanistan, where we saw major gains by these parties in the last election?
Even there, because that was the mainstream parties, especially the conservative PML, was not allowed to function and campaign properly, and the intelligence services actually helped the MMA. They might have won a slim majority, but certainly not enough to govern effectively. In fact, they're not governing effectively now. They're handicapped because the government in Islamabad doesn't want them to implement many of the more radical proposals that they campaigned on.
Samina Ahmed, we think we have an understanding of why the Saudi government made common cause with fundamentalist Muslims and even Islamists. What about Musharraf's Pakistan government? Why?
Well, you have to say the military government. I think we're reducing this to personalities as though General Musharraf decides everything that happens.
No, we take your point, and you made it, and it's a good one.
Yeah?
The military that he represents, yes.
Absolutely. The military government sides with the Islamic parties because it perceives, quite naturally, the real threat to continuity from the moderate secular parties, which have popular support. So who does it turn to? It turns to the religious right that is as dependent, as Steve said, on the military for support as well because it doesn't have a popular base. So it's a relationship which of an alliance of convenience. It's worked well enough. But in the end, these kinds of alliances mean that you have a price to pay, and the price is being paid now through the rise of Islamic extremism and sectarian violence. The jihad that we talk about in the Pakistani context mm-hmm. is a jihad by the Islamic extremists against Pakistanis and against outsiders. So it's both an internal and an external jihad.
So if we follow your logic through, does that mean that Washington cannot ultimately get into league with Musharraf and the Pakistani military to oppose Islamists and terrorists because the military depends on those same groups?
Here's the thing. If President Bush had said in the context of the Middle East and Southeast Asia, well, there are no shortcuts to stability, right? Really can't quite understand why that isn't applied to the Pakistani context. There certainly aren't any shortcuts to stability here other than the one course that Bush said Muslim-majority countries should adopt, which is a democratic course. The U.S. doesn't seem interested in the Pakistani context of actually supporting that course. It would rather support a military government.
And not deal with the messiness of a more democratic situation,
absolutely.
But it's not getting what it wants from that.
Democracies are messy, but democracies lead to the kinds of solutions that would actually promote U.S. policies.
Samina Ahmed, Stephen Cohen, stand by. I want to invite our callers in. Sultan is calling from Salem, New Hampshire. Hi, Sultan. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I just came back from Pakistan after 3 weeks of long trip. I went from small villages to big cities and extended family from blue-collar worker to really educated one.
And what did you find, Sultan?
And what I did say, I think you're trivializing the issue. I think it's a certain shade of, Islamic extremist and versus that. I think there's a broader discontent there. I was surprised myself because I have pretty good opinion about Musharraf, but when I went there, I was amazed to see how much widespread discontent with him and on the other side with the United States, and because he's fighting with that. The main thing is that, for example, they feel that Pakistan is being again used by United States for the purpose and then leave it as did it many times before after 10 years war against Soviet Union.
So you're really picking up Samina Ahmed's perspective here.
And then they say for the United States, they see the people, the plane loads of Pakistani being expelled, their business destroyed and moved from. They are all stories all over that how they were treated and supposed to be.
Pakistanis being pushed out of the United States.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Plane loads of people having business destroyed and all that, coming back and telling all kind of stories and jails and all kind of stuff.
So what's the bottom line, Sultan?
Pardon me?
What's the bottom line then? What do you take away from this?
I think it's the fault is also on the U.S. policy that they are treating Pakistan as, again, like a toilet paper. They use it and that, and discontent is widespread. And they feel that this time again they will use Pakistan and leave it though as they are. And they also feel very threatened by this new thing with the India and surrounded by Afghanistan, now a very kind of hostile state and not friendly one, and India and the balance of power, conventional power, is, you know, getting tremendous against Pakistan. You know, India is getting all kind of modern weapons from all over the
world. Yes, right. So tell me, we've got the perspective, and thanks for the fresh report from Pakistan. Stephen Cohen, what do you make of this general line of critique that the United States has kind of made the bed, now it's sleeping in it, and it's not fun?
Well, that's exactly what I heard in Pakistan when I was there a couple of months ago. And I've been going to Pakistan since the early 70s. I've never seen Pakistanis so angry with the United States. They're not anti-American so much. They like America, they like Americans, but they're angry with American policy, and I think our government has been inept in this relationship. They've allowed the perception to grow that we are using Pakistan for our own purposes. We're making up with the Indians, and we really don't care much about Pakistan. And when you look at our aid programs to Pakistan, our educational and information programs, I think that's a correct perception. We're not putting much money in a country which is, it won't fall apart now, but I'm very worried about the future of Pakistan after another generation or so. Then I think we might have a monster state. But we simply don't have the capacity in our government to look ahead and see these problems as they come across the horizon.
So Stephen Cohen, I have the impression, I wonder about yours, that the view that Washington is putting forward is something different. It's that we have to stand by this Musharraf because the military there, because they can stand up to this Islamist threat, and we really have little choice now. It's just the exigencies of the war on terror. What do you mean, let's have elections and get democratic? Lord knows what would happen then. We'd have a bigger mess in our hands. Isn't that the kind of message?
I think that, you know, we haven't made clear in our own eyes that we would like to see restoration of in our own mind, a restoration of democracy in Pakistan, and above all, I think a strengthening of the institutions that sustain a democracy. What happened during the 10 years of democracy in Pakistan, and the 10 years or earlier during the Zia regime, is a lot of the institutions that would allow democracy to function in Pakistan sort of systematically been undercut, especially education and other groups and the political parties. And I think the U.S. should pay as much attention to that as it does to the war on terrorism with Pakistan. I do think we need to support Musharraf. There's no doubt in my mind that we shouldn't weaken our support for him. But by supporting him, we're supporting an institution, the army. And we need to make it clear to the army that they've got to move domestically in terms of internal reform and also in terms of the dialogue with India. And I think that the recent summit meetings and the recent SARC meetings in Islamabad are very, very important. I don't know if they're turning points, but they do indicate perhaps a change of thinking in the army itself and Pakistan's establishment about the need to normalize relations with India. One of the major uses of the jihadis was against India.
Yes, and, in Kashmir.
And if Pakistanis see a peace process evolving towards on Kashmir and a more normal relationship with India, then they can dispense with those jihadis. There's still a problem in Afghanistan, and the Afghans are sure that the Pakistanis are supporting Islamic radicals there, but that's a separate policy issue.
And Samina Ahmed, what's your view? Should the United States somehow come in, push very hard toward free, open, democratic elections? And if it should do that, can it do it with confidence that it will end up with a government that it feels it can work with in the war on terrorism?
Let me put it this way, that in the last election, despite the manipulation, despite the rigging, despite the pressure, despite the electoral tactics used by the military, the Islamic parties still combined, which is the MMA, the six-party alliance, gained 11.5% of the national vote. Now, this just goes to show how much support the mainstream moderate parties have. And by the way, I mean, it seems so interesting that the mainstream parties happen to be pro-American, happen to support American goals in the region, happen to be anti-Islamic extremists, happen to oppose al-Qaeda. So it is difficult to understand why the United States believes that a functioning democracy would threaten U.S. interests. That said, I think it's equally important that one needs to figure out what's happening in Pakistan now. We're not talking 6 months ago or 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. In December, Musharraf reached an agreement, as Ahmed Rashid said, with the MMA, with the religious right.
Yes.
That has given him his self-assumed presidency, an extension of another 5 years, 2007.
Right.
What are we talking about? We're talking about a military government deciding to sustain itself for another 5 years.
And doing it in an agreement with hardline Islamist opposition parties.
Absolutely, and with the support of the United States. Now, there is a contradiction, a clear contradiction in U.S. policy. It supports a military government that is propped up by Islamic extremists.
It is
trying to prevent Islamic extremism.
It's an old story, and it doesn't look good. Naveen is calling from Granby, Connecticut. Hi, Naveen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much. Great show, guys. A couple of things I wanted to mention. I heard Dr. Emmett talk about how it is very likely that there'll be a reasonably calm transition to the next one in line.
Within the military framework, yes. If there were an assassination, yes.
If there were an assassination, specifically she referred to what happened in 1988. I got to mention that the situation today is vastly different than it was in 1988. The Islamists today have much more power, whether it's due to internal resentment among the masses, the poorer people of Pakistan,
right,
or with the support of external forces. The jihadis in Pakistan are much more powerful today than they were in 1988.
So you're not so confident in a smooth transition there.
I think there'll be utter chaos. Mind you, I am originally from India, and I'm no great supporter of Pakistan in general. But I have always believed that Musharraf probably makes the most sense under the circumstances.
So what do you think about the assassination attempts in the last several weeks, Naveen?
Again, please.
What do you make of the assassination attempts then?
Oh, I have a theory about that. I think the one thing that Musharraf can do to make himself the most powerful man in Pakistan ever is to arrive at some sort of agreement with India. My theory here is that much of this is staged. Musharraf is extremely powerful. Mind you, this is the guy that came to power sitting in a plane while he was outside the country.
Why would he stage assassination attempts on his own life?
The attempt is to gain leverage against India by using the good offices of the U.S., which may not necessarily be a bad idea, mind you.
So to get stronger U.S. support. Naveen, we're almost to a break, but we've got your point. We thank you for making it. Samin Ahmed, does that make any sense to you, staged assassination attempts?
Rumors circulating in Pakistan that the first assassination attempt might not have been an assassination attempt, might have been stage managed. But I think with the second and 15 people killed, well, I don't think that would have been stage managed.
It just looks too real, too close to the bone. Stephen Cohen, do you agree?
I agree. I think that's true. And I think that I can pretty much identify the people who did it or tried to do it. My guess is that they're alumni of the intelligence services working with disaffected radicals in Pakistan, people they used to work with. And my guess is also that this is a last gasp for them, that their strength is declining, not increasing, which is true of al-Qaeda on a global basis.
No, there's two interesting thoughts. We've got to come back and catch up with those. Stephen Cohen, Samin Ahmed, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the precarious presidency of Pakistan's General Pervez Musharraf. You can join the conversation. Who is trying to kill the president of Pakistan? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the precarious presidency of Pakistan's General Pervez Musharraf, president of Pakistan. You can join the conversation tonight. Are two assassination attempts in 2 weeks a new wake-up call to the power of al-Qaeda and its friends in the region, or are they a last gasp? If the next bomb, the next bullet gets Musharraf, what's the impact on Pakistan, on the war on terror? And can Musharraf line up with Washington and live? Is it time for real elections in Pakistan? Is it past time? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight from Karachi by Samin Ahmed, Project Director for Pakistan at the International Crisis Group, and from Washington by Stephen Cohen, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. Samir is calling from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Samir. You're on the air.
Hi there. If I could use a football metaphor, Mr. Musharraf, General Musharraf is like this skilled running back who kind of, every time he gets tackled, he cuts back, changes direction, and runs. And the ball he has is Pakistan's nuclear assets. And let's hope if at all he were to go down, he passes it to some other general. But if he were to fumble the ball, do you think some other players like the CIA, the Mossad, the RA, the MI5 would recover that ball? Because that cannot be fumbled.
You're talking about that falling in to the hands of people who might use it to terrorize?
Pretty much everybody else, yes.
Pretty much everybody. Well, it's a great question.
I mean, as ironical as it may sound, but Pakistani army would perhaps be the sanest element in Pakistan.
But on the other hand, Samir, we're hearing this evening that it may be in no small part the lack of democratic elections and the army at the top, the military at the top, that's provoking all the trouble in Pakistan.
They have their own bad apples, but I still think it's the army. I mean, democratic Pakistan is probably going to be more dangerous to the world.
Samir, thank you for your call. Stephen Cohen, take us into this nexus between political power and nuclear arms in Pakistan. We've all read in the last day or two some new reporting on how much exportation of nuclear know-how and technology and materials Pakistan has done. What's the game that's being played here, and what's the security level of that nuclear weapons in Pakistan?
Well, the weapons themselves are, I've been told and I understand, are under pretty tight security. And I was in India a few months ago, and the Indians assured me that Americans knew where the Pakistani nuclear weapons were. We could take them out if we wanted to. As the metaphor said, if Musharraf fumbled the ball, mm-hmm. the Americans would be there to catch him. That's probably not true. It's very difficult, I think, to figure out where those weapons are, and certainly to mount a strike or an attack to capture them. So, and in a sense, the caller was right that that's Musharraf's last card and Pakistan's last card. Unlike an ordinary state, if Pakistan were to deteriorate and fall apart, it could start spewing out nuclear weapons in all directions. The question of the leakage of nuclear material to the Iran and to North Korea and perhaps other countries is a national scandal for the Pakistanis. They've been caught lying. The Pakistan government's been caught lying.
But what's the motivation, and who has been in favor of that export?
I think Pakistan has a sort of informal nexus of Islamists, ex-intelligence people, some people in the government, and they do this for both profit and for what they see as Pakistan's national interest. They see developing these ties with both extremists and terrorists, and also with other countries through the nuclear program, as to their personal advantage and also to the country's advantage. Now, this is not a strategy that America and most other countries would agree with. In a sense, they've been doing this while the government has been publicly saying that they don't do it. And in a sense, this is another chicken that's come home to roost. I like the metaphor for Pervez Musharraf. You know, he's been saying all along, we didn't do this, but in fact they have done it, and they were turned in by the Iranians, of all people.
Sabina, Ahmed, why would Pakistan do that? They had to know that the United States would, I don't know, freak out at that kind of export. What's the value? What's the worth that makes it worth that?
Has the United States freaked out? When the information on the transfer of technology to North Korea became public, that was quite some time back, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that was in exchange for, as General Musharraf said, in exchange for North Korean missile technology. Did the United States freak out? No, it didn't. Part of the problem.
Well, it proclaimed an axis of evil a couple of years ago and proclaimed a new fundamental military strategy of preemptive strikes. I mean, these are fairly large steps.
No, hold on. We're talking about Pakistan here.
Yeah.
And we're talking about the U.S.-Pakistani relationship. We're not talking about the U.S.-North Korean relationship.
But I'm,
did
if,
it freak
if,
out?
If, yeah, well, no, if, it if these nuclear exports precipitated a fundamental change in U.S. military policy, at least in part, that yeah. seems like a fairly significant step.
I think part of the problem, again, is, and I would say this very, very strongly, is because U.S. non-proliferation policy has been very selective. They're the bad guys, North Korea, Libya, Iran, and they are our buddies, India and Pakistan and Israel. When you have selective non-proliferation policies, they don't work either. That's another shortcut that hasn't worked, and that is pretty much where South Asia is right now, on the verge of having operational nuclear weapons in the field.
Mm. Stephen Cohen, I hear you there.
Yeah, I would take a somewhat different perspective on that. I think what's happened is that when Pakistan developed its nuclear program, America became aware of it and imposed sanctions. But just at that moment, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, and we calculated, right. The American government calculated, Jimmy Carter calculated, that it was more important to get Pakistan's cooperation in defeating the Soviets or balancing the Soviets than to clamp down on Pakistan's nuclear program. In 2001, we again knew what the Pakistanis were up to. They were under triple layers of sanctions. They were, you know, they weren't hurting Pakistan that much, right. But they were sanctioned. Mm-hmm. But then Al-Qaeda happened, and 9/11 happened, and again, we needed Pakistan. So what's happened is that Pakistan has been very fortunate in the sense that a major international crisis has come along just about the time when America is fed up with Pakistan, and they've used this and exploited it to their own end and developed a nuclear program. Let me say one point about Al-Qaeda and Pakistan's mm-hmm. role. I think you have to at least give the Pakistanis credit for having turned over a number of Al-Qaeda members. Their count is 600. The American count is somewhat lower, but they have been fairly active in Pakistan itself in rounding up Al-Qaeda who came in from Afghanistan.
And U.S. Special Forces have at least a couple of bases in Pakistan now doing exactly that.
Yeah, we have two full-fledged military bases in Pakistan operating from Pakistan to Afghanistan. That's a major asset, and I think that's one thing that gives the American administration pause before it's too critical of the military regime in Pakistan.
Mm. Tor is calling from Cape Cod. Hi, Tor, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Rick. Tom, it's a pleasure to speak with you and all your distinguished guests.
Good to have you, Tor. What's on your mind?
I have several comments to make, but this incredible discussion could solve this problem, looking back on past administration efforts to bring together emphasis on geopolitical unity regarding Kashmir and the interests of Pakistan and India to solve this problem by participating at a different level, at a level of higher consciousness in order to sort of go beyond or circumnavigate what is missing from the current administration's...
So are you saying you want to see Washington more involved in a solution to the Kashmir standoff?
Well, yeah, I think there could be. There just has to be a presence of more of a USA in terms of, you know, promoting what is good about the USA and not so much of military strategy as to how to always govern everything by nuclear weapons. Rather, how about a little more working with a farmer to see if he's getting a good price for his rice, whether he's Pakistani or Indian.
So coming at a more organic level. Our time is growing short, Tor, but let me pick that up. Samin Ahmed, what about the U.S. Influence behind these current talks between Pakistan and India, and what about over Kashmir overall? Can Washington really be effective in helping them finally make some progress on that front?
I think this is the one area in which the United States has played an incredibly constructive role. It was U.S. engagement with both India and Pakistan prevented war, not just last year. I mean, we're talking last year.
Yes.
India and Pakistan came that close to war
Very
in 1999,
mm-hmm.
once again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's U.S. pressure that's getting pressure and persuasion that's getting the two sides to keep on talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the U.S., if it keeps on engaging in this constructive fashion, will at least prevent another catastrophe. Between India and Pakistan, we're talking about, 1.5 billion people.
You know, given the history there, that's a pretty great accomplishment given the history. Stephen Cohen, a last thought from you. You said in the next few years you're fairly confident, longer term you're not. What's the scenario that worries you?
I'm more worried about the deeper structural problems of Pakistan. I think that I'm worried about the short term. You know, if Musharraf is assassinated, mm-hmm. what happens then? Could be chaos, could be more assassinations. That's a problem. But I also think American policy should address the longer term issues, reconstructing Pakistan's educational system, which has been taken over by the fundamentalists,
mm-hmm.
Urging Pakistan to reform its economy, get in tune with the global economy. A lot of things that we could be doing, and we should offer offering inducements to Pakistan, not simply of a policy of sanctions, which has been our past policy, or a policy of ignoring Pakistan. I think we left it alone, and our relationship with India, which I very much favor, you know, led us to forget about Pakistan until 9/11 took place, and that was, in a sense, no good deed goes unpunished.
And we've got a tough picture there right now. We're out of time, but Stephen Cohen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. Good talking to Samina.
Yes, Stephen Cohen at the Brookings Institution and Samina Ahmed, who got up so nice and early in Karachi to join us. Thank you very much. Wonderful to have you.
Thanks, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Samina Ahmed with the International Crisis Group. In a moment, verifying the voice of the world's most wanted man. This is On Point. Yesterday, the Al Jazeera satellite television channel broadcast another audio tape purported to be a message from Osama bin Laden. The tape referred to the capture of former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein and called on Muslims to keep fighting a holy war against occupiers in the Middle East. After a CIA analysis, the White House confirmed that the tape probably is of bin Laden's voice. Tom Owen is an expert on voice identification who has been called on by the federal government to authenticate bin Laden tapes and videos. In this radio diary, Tom Owen talks about the process of sifting through words and sounds to identify the voice of one of the world's most wanted men.
The history of voice analysis really starts at the end of around 1878, 1888, when Alexander Graham Bell's father, Alexander Melvin Bell, was using a system of writing to teach the deaf how to speak. He called it visible speech. In 1942, they actually, as a war effort, they started spectrographic analysis in order to track the German Signal Corps commanders as they moved with their divisions from place to place in Europe. And that was the purpose originally of voice identification. They would track the divisions, the German divisions, by the sound of the voices of the radio operator. For voice identification, basically, it's a comparison between the known and the unknown. The unknown tape, our voice, is the voice which we would like to know who it is. The known is the person that we're going to compare it to. In the Osama bin Laden case, the known was the Jonathan Miller interview from ABC television, where he was actually sitting in a tent with Osama bin Laden and asking him questions. So that was a very, very good, high-quality known, because we see him on camera, we know it's him, and we know it's him speaking. The unknown would be the tape that Al Jazeera had broadcast. In the Osama bin Laden tape from this weekend, the most recent tape, I noticed that in comparison to the November tape, there's a quicker pace to the rate of speech. Also, this tape is much higher quality than the Al Jazeera tape from November of 2002. And I noticed that there were some words that Osama bin Laden has spoken in other areas, especially the Jonathan Miller interview, that would be comparable. Words like Allah, words like the United States, words like Americans, words like infidel, that sort of thing. If you listen to Osama bin Laden's speeches, those words are said in practically every speech he makes. And if we were to take those known words and compare them to various words that are in this particular new tape, I think it would more than be an adequate comparison. And you compare them by listening to them, and you compare them by spectrographic analysis, or what are commonly referred to as voice prints. A voice print is 14 inches long. Basically, it looks like a pattern of light and dark formats is what we call them. And they have certain shapes, and they go up on a slant or they go down on a slant. So certain vowels and so forth would have an upward swooping. And you can tell that they're vowels just by looking at them. And it's the same way each time you say it. And we can look at these formats and we can tell if you can get them to say that the same way in the known and in the unknown, then you can make a direct A-B comparison. And you're comparing apples to apples and not apples to oranges. You know, you can attempt to mimic. We've even done studies with Rich Little where he mimicked Humphrey Bogart and Richard Nixon and John Wayne and other people. And then we did spectrographic analysis with the real voices. We found that although it could sound somewhat similar, spectrographically they look different. It would be pretty tough to fake unless the tape itself had an inordinate amount of noise involved with it. Then it would be easier for someone to commit a forgery, and that's why you have to be very judicious in the samples that you use and the comparisons that you make.
Tom Owen is CEO of Owl Investigations, Inc. He's been identifying voices for 22 years. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.